Welcome to Spoken Web Shortcuts. Each month on alternate fortnights, that's every second week following the monthly Spoken Web podcast episode, you can join me, Hannah McGregor, and our Minisode host and curator, Catherine McLeod, for Spoken Web's Shortcuts mini-series. We'll share with you specially curated audio clips from deep in the Spoken Web archives to ask, what does it mean to cut and splice digitally? What kinds of new stories and audio criticism can be produced through these short archival clips? Shortcuts is an extension of the Shortcuts blog posts on Spoken Web blog. So if you love what you hear, make sure to head over to spokenweb.ca for more. If you're a researcher with the Spoken Web project, think about joining Catherine on Shortcuts to discuss an archival clip that has impacted your work, especially if you're a student who has been digitizing and cataloging recordings and there's a sound that stands out to you after all those hours of listening. Let Catherine know. Pitch Catherine your audio by emailing spokenwebpodcast@gmail.com. Now, here is Catherine McLeod with Spoken Web Shortcuts, mini stories about how literature sounds.
Welcome to Shortcuts, where we listen closely and carefully to a short cut from Spoken Web's audio collections. On this episode, we'll be listening to an audio clip from a performance by Griffin Poetry Prize winning poet Kai Kello. It's a recording of him reading at the Words and Music show in Montreal back in November 2016. You may even remember this clip. It was featured previously on Shortcuts. It's a memorable recording in which Kello's introduction to a poem becomes the poem. I thought I'd return to this clip partly as a response to the most recent full episode of the Spoken Web podcast, and do check that out if you haven't already. And also because I've always wanted to ask Kello about that performance. What are we listening to? And what does it feel like for him to listen to that recording? So let's travel back in time to the Words and Music show at Casa del Popolo in Montreal in 2016. Kai Kello is on stage and he is thanking host Ian Ferrier for the introduction, and he's about to start his set. We'll hear a recording of that first, and then we'll jump into my recent conversation on Zoom with Kai Kello. We started that conversation by listening to the same recording. Or, as I said to him, I'll play this very short clip and we'll listen to it together.
We'll play the very short clip and we can listen to it together.
Sounds good.
And so let me just share this.
Hello. Thanks, Ian, for that introduction. And thanks to all of the other artists tonight. It's been a very nice night. I'm going to present something for you that is... somewhat narrative, I guess, but it isn't related to my novel. It's some other narratives, and the narratives are related to adolescence, which is a peculiar time in life, and I think that they're relevant nowadays because they're related to adolescence in a particular place and time. In Alberta, in the 1980s,
high school fever,
in the moment of heavy evangelical
who drank themselves to
activity
death
and
macho
extreme conservatism,
trying to prove
and
to themselves that they
some
exist,
of the challenges that,
night
that arise
into next
when
day's
growing
headlines.
Up and trying
to
live and
my
become
conviction
oneself
that a boy had to be
in a climate like
a
that, which
that
seems
Caribbean
to be a climate that.
Had
that,
to be
that,
spiked
that is re-emerging
rum,
in spite of
amber alcohol
all of
the DNA
all of the,
that seeped down centuries
all of
from
the
slavery.
Appearances to the contrary that had appeared
in a far-flung suburb
in the past,
of empire.
The
a
idea that
slum, a bubble
that
born
that,
yesterday,
that
or a 12
born
pack
yesterday
of empties,
was finished,
or a bubble in
and
a
that
bottle,
it
a
was
in
gone
back seat.
And, and done,
froth
and suddenly a wave
archived by teenage brains, autobiography of an outsider screened at the drive-in.
Has crashed
Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme. The jaws of life rend and pry it open
suddenly
like a crumpled tuna can. Everybody is
suddenly
unconscious.
A wave
is bleeding
has
his
crashed
deer from their lisps.
So that was recorded at the Words and Music show back in 2016. And I'm wondering, what are we listening to there? What are we hearing?
Wow. 2016. I didn't realize it was that long ago. Actually, what you're listening to is a passage from the manuscript of Magnetic Equator. I mean, that was a very, very, very early iteration of that. And it was one of the themes that became a sort of major thread in the book, which was writing about sort of adolescence in Western Canada in the 80s and 90s. But what I was trying to do in the performance was, in live vocal performance, one of the things that is a huge concern is that you only have one voice at a time, right? So how do you multiply that? How do you get to have maybe two voices or three voices at a time, mm-hmm. or half a voice? How does that work? So you can multiply or divide voice. And that instantly makes, I think, the sonic field and the vocal field a little bit richer. And then if you can overlap them or layer them or have them speak across one another and sometimes sync up and sometimes diverge, then it becomes not just multiple voices, but it becomes an interplay among multiple voices, a sort of directed movement. So one problem was, how do you get around having just one voice in performance? And then what happens when you have multiple voices? What do you do with them? Then another concern is that sometimes in live oral performance, the poet or the presenter plays like these dual roles and sort of toggles between them. There's the role of the poet or the MC, the master of ceremonies, where you say, okay, so now this next poem that I'm going to present is about, and it's you, right? And the human being, and you crack a couple of jokes, you present the poem, or you say something important about it, and then you present the poem. But when you present the poem, you shift into another persona. That's the performer. So, that kind of movement back and forth, it's I've always liked to kind of try to subvert that and not to emphasize that too much or find ways of blending it. So the introduction becomes the poem. Or the introduction, in this case, winds up entering into dialogue with the poem. The voice that was the poem was recorded into a Zoom recorder. And then that Zoom was, so I was, I had a bunch of electronics in front of me at the time. So there's a visual part of the performance that can't be seen in that intro clip. And so it's sort of the playing up the part of sort of the befuddled electronic button tweaker, right? Trying to say something meanwhile being distracted by the machine, and your voice gets overtaken by the machine. But also, so there's my voice going through a clean microphone, and then there's a second voice which has been recorded into a Zoom, and that's being played through there are three voices. So there's my voice introducing the poem, there's a second voice that's going through a mixer and out to the house, and that's a recorded voice. And then there's a third recorded voice that's going back into an effects pedal and then out. So there can always, from the recording, there can always be a clean channel and a channel that is run through effects. And I was running it through this really interesting analog delay pedal that doesn't sound like your usual delay, but it sort of breaks up and fragments the source sound.
Nowhere, this prairie.
So eventually the voice would start to like it would sound like
this
tape delay, like squiggling and fragmenting and breaking up.
Wandering out of time, this shithole built by oil money, this fort where raw tobacco.
But yeah, so there could potentially be three voices, mine, the clean recorded, and the broken.
And I guess the fact that Ian Ferrier recorded every Words of Music show, then we have this version, all three voices are captured in Ian's recording in an interesting way that then it's like we have one iteration of it, but it would never have been performed the same way twice.
There was another thing, I remember this performance, and what I was thinking about was, pardon me, was also having the introduction to the poem be sort of halting, mm-hmm. and failing to progress fluidly. And so I wanted to have the work come up under that. So to give the impression that I didn't know exactly what I might be doing, and then have the poem take over in a moment of uncertainty. But yeah, thanks to Ian for recording that stuff, because it was an experiment, you know. I've been playing with it at home, and I got the chance to experiment. I think that might have been a bill that Paul Dutton was on too.
To imagine then hearing that alongside one of Paul Dutton's performances too, that's even adds even more. I think too, thinking about what you talked about is the almost like the hesitant introduction. It felt like that worked so well too with the poem, because it felt like kind of thinking back, okay, back to adolescence, oh, like the kind of hesitating kind of feeling of it, like, oh, do I want to go back, or so it sort of felt like that hesitancy was also connected to a bit of the kind of emotional distance from that time too. And really, really hearing that process, it really, it feels like we're listening to a process unfolding in the way that the introduction moves into the poem. It feels like, it's a very important part of the process of how the poem evolved eventually to become what it is on the page.
Okay, no, the poem changed a lot between that iteration in 2016 and what was later kind of the edited version that was wound up being published. The one that was performed in 2016, I can definitely say that the poem had probably been written within, weeks of that performance. I was trying to play with the idea that the sense that maybe the person who was presenting the poems was not fully competent. Their confidence was wavering, and those are not things that you're supposed to perform, right? Once you get up in the moment of performance, it's supposed to be pure expertise and excellence, right? And difficulty, hesitancy, those things are not supposed to be there. Those are supposed to be, you're supposed to gloss those over with a sense of know-how, mm-hmm. and knowing what to do in the moment. And so how do you approach a performance and, I guess, get around the need for constant expertise throughout, right? Because those other experiences are part of the experience of performing. Even if you don't perform them, you feel them while you're performing. You feel hesitant, your brain is racing, you're not sure what to say next. You don't necessarily always feel totally capable when you go up there to perform. So how do you emphasize that in a way that works within the context of the performance?
Hearing this now in the archive, how does this recording sort of sit for you in time?
Yeah, it's interesting because it does sit. I mean, it does sit as something that it's like a board tap from a live event, right? There's a rawer quality to it. And then, like, if this were made in a studio, it would have been a different piece because it would have been created for audio, right? It would be created exclusively as an audio piece. And there would have been really limited emphasis on the visual aspect of performance and that communication with an audience. It would have been much more, it would have been elaborate in a different way as a sonic object. That does cross my mind. I mean, and that's not necessarily a negative thing. What I mean by that is that that just kind of establishes the further context for what it was, you know? And that was one of the nice things about Wired on Words. If you wanted, you could accept Ian's invitation to go to the show, and you could repeat the same work that you repeated 2 months before that, and 3 months before that, and 6 months before that, right? But I accepted a lot of Ian's invitations, and I always tried to take them as opportunities to attempt something slightly different. And so I might have repeated myself sometimes, but I was really, really trying to move away from that. And that helped me because there was the thought that I could consistently develop new work. And it didn't have to be perfect and flawless to go out to be presented to the public, but it could be developed and developing towards something. And in the moment of performance, if I could communicate that well enough, people would grasp that. That was also, it also felt like it was the context of the show. There was a looseness to it that kind of allowed for that. It was, you know, I mean, it was a show, right? So you were presenting somewhat finished works to the public. But the thing about it was that there's something very casual about it too.
I feel that the Words and Music show still feels that way. And it's amazing to have kind of to continue having that spirit through over 20 years of having the show. So.
Oh yeah. Especially thinking about it now. I mean, we're in the fourth or fifth wave of the pandemic and everything shut down again. A lot, you know, the literary world has, and the world of literature and performance has kind of migrated online with varying degrees of success. You know, I don't think like the world of performance, I mean, you know, it's difficult to feel any inspiration toward performance when you're sitting in your living room, right?
Yeah.
It just seems so ridiculous. And so to think back on the freedom to just, you know, roll out to a venue close by home and to be able to perform and to benefit from what you were talking about earlier about, I mean, that's what we don't benefit from with online events, the being able to mill about and talk with people after the event. And like when with an online event, you're there for the event.
Yeah.
And there may be some back and forth in the comments or in the chat, but generally you're there for the event. And with live events, you were partly there for the event, but then there was all of the other stuff that went on in between performances, in between sets. Like if I would bring a bunch of gear there, like pedals and synths and stuff like that, other musicians would come up on stage and we would chat about the equipment and about gear and, oh, what can this panel in your synth do? What, how did you use this pedal? Oh, I have one that does this, and so on and so on. And there would also be some casual impromptu learning that would take place. Someone might ask you if you've ever used one of your pieces of equipment in such and such a way and might show you how to do something with it. So that possibility too was really very much a part of those or how did you get that sound, you know? And then you could share information about that. And that learning was a big part of those events too.
Yeah, it's we're definitely missing it. Well, I think that's a beautiful note to end on. I want to thank you so much, Kai, for joining me and talking about this clip from Words and Music show and what we're listening to.
Oh, thanks for having me, and thanks for asking me and reminding me of the clip. You know, you asked me what it was like, what I thought about when hearing it, and it's strange. It's strange to hear that kind of reflection of yourself, and to, I didn't realize that it was as far back as 2016, because it feels a lot sooner. I remember what I was thinking about. I remember what my poetic preoccupations were at the time. I remember how far that poem came, because it was young and sentimental when I wrote it. And then it was not like that by the time it was published. It took on a different sort of personality by the time it was published. But yeah, I remember everything that I was thinking about. I remember how excited I was about it. Yeah, it's just so thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Shortcuts. My guest this month was poet Kai Kello. Shortcuts is mixed and mastered by Judith Burr, hosted by Hannah McGregor, transcribed by Kelly Cubbin, and produced by me, Catherine McLeod. Thanks for listening.